Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our afternoon panel discussion. One of the big stories of this year across the UK has been the Green Surge, the enormous growth in support and membership of the Green parties across the British Isles. Here in Northern Ireland, we've seen our membership double over the past 6 months, and local groups form across the region. I'm joined this afternoon by our deputy leader, Claire Bailey, who's the Westminster candidate for South Belfast, the largest Green group in Northern Ireland. I'm also joined by Adam Ramsey of the Green Party in England and Wales, and co-editor of Open Democracy. Right. Adam's written in depth about the Green Surge and what it means for our future. I'm also joined by Zara Kitson of the Scottish Greens, who's the MP candidate for Glasgow North East and co-convener of Glasgow and West Scotland Greens, and by Roderick O'Gorman, chair of the Green Party in Ireland. Thank you all very much. My name's Tanya Jones. I'm the membership secretary for GPNI and Westminster candidate for Fermanagh and South Tyrone. So, Adam, perhaps we can start with you. What is the Green Surge, and is that the right name for it?
Hello. Does this mic work, or shall I take this one here? Or both of them and have weird interference? Thank you for having me. It's so great to be back in Belfast, and so wonderful to see so many of you here today. What is the Green Surge? Well, you are, was Stephen's answer. I thought I'd just kick off with some stats, because I always enjoy a good statistic. So around this time last year, across the three Green parties of the UK, so England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, we had about 14,000 members. As of today, I was just doing the sums, and I think we have 66,000 members. And I think it's important not to underemphasise the significance of that historically. That means that Greens are bigger than UKIP. bigger than the Lib Dems. And as a bit of a geek in England, I always make sure we include our Northern Irish friends, and sometimes people say, well, that means you have to include Alliance. And so I then reply, well, yes, but we're also bigger than the Lib Dems plus Alliance. And historically, it's also very interesting. I mean, the Communist Party, at its peak in 1943, had 60,000 members, which means that the Green Parties of the UK are now what I would see as the biggest ever sort of radical left political party in British history. The other contender is the ILP in the 1930s at around 30,000 members. So you know, historically, it's unprecedented, and really, you know, worth noting. The UK now has more Green Party members than any other country in Europe. Germany has 60,000, so we've overtaken them by quite a way. So the first thing to say is to everyone who has participated in that, whether by joining yourself or by recruiting people, congratulations. It's quite significant. And I think it's worth thinking about why it's happened and what it is that changed. And I think that there's external things and, what's more important for us in a sense, internal things, because we can't change the external stuff, but we can learn from what we've done well and what we've done less well in the past and keep doing the good stuff, hopefully. So I'll just quickly touch on the external stuff. I don't know how long I've got, so do shut me up.
Yeah, I'll shut you up.
Because I'd happily talk about this for hours. So, I mean, externally, you know, we look across Europe and you're seeing the same phenomenon to an extent. You know, I was in Greece for the elections there back in January, and what you saw was a party which had been getting 5% of the vote 5 years ago, swept into government, and now, just looking at the polls today, on 45% support. You know, a party which the Green Party of Greece is a part of, and which runs basically on the same manifesto as us. I mean, if you go through Syriza's whole broad manifesto, it's pretty much identical to those that Green parties across the UK stand on, you know, going from 5%. Obviously, Greece has very specific circumstances, but that's still significant. Look at Podemos, who are leading the polls in Spain, again, very much on the same manifesto as we're standing on, having been founded around a year ago, coming first in the European elections and leading the polls up into the Spanish general elections in December. And so what we're seeing across Europe, and in fact you could argue across the world if you look at a couple of years ago at the rise of the NDP in Canada and so on, is a whole realignment on the left, where traditional parties of the centre-left who'd bought into a sort of failing, corrupted political economic system are being wiped out by rising new parties. And, you know, I think it's important we see ourselves as being a part of that broader trend. You know, that's a profound change in the nature of politics, and we are, you know, Greens saw that wave coming, that tidal wave coming, and we grabbed the surfboard and we looked on in glee. And at the moment we're riding that wave, and let's try not fall off it. But more importantly, you know, within the UK, you know, there's different things, I think, happening in each place. And I don't know as much about Northern Ireland as you do, so what I'm going to talk quickly about is the other bits. So in Scotland, you know, most of the growth, I mean, I'm originally Scottish, you wouldn't guess from my accent, but most of the growth there happened literally in the space of 3 days, when the Green Party in Scotland grew from 1,800 members to around 8,000 members in the 3 days after the referendum. You know, the membership of the party over the course of, like, 5 hours, the number of people who joined over 5 hours was more than the number who joined in the previous 30 years. And again, what that shows is that, you know, that huge energy, I think, that was already there, the desire for a new politics that was unleashed by the referendum. I think that desire for new politics exists really across the Western world. I don't think that Scotland was any different. The only thing that was different there was that the referendum tapped into that energy. And Greens did well there because they were good at articulating a broad sense of frustration with a political economic system which is failing to deliver for people. And I think, and this is sort of controversial, but also we're forced to talk about something other than the environment. And people are forced to listen to us talking about something other than the environment. And as soon as we did, people discovered that we have by far the most popular policies on a whole range of issues. And you know, opinion polls consistently show that. They consistently show that whether it's public ownership of the railways, whether it's regulation of the banks, that, you know, our policies are much more popular than other parties, but the media tries to tell us otherwise. And as soon as people were forced to engage with our other policies beyond a sort of very narrow set, that unleashed a huge wave of popularity for us. And I think the same is true in England, only with austerity. So, you know, what's happened in England is that you've got a huge number of people. You know, the most popular position in opinion polls relating to fiscal policy, to tax and spend, in England is to end austerity. You know, consistently, if you ask people, about 36% want to end austerity, about 20% are happy with austerity, another 20% take the kind of Labour position of maybe a bit different kind of austerity, but, you know, but don't like what's happening now. But, you know, plurality position is to end austerity. There's no other major party articulating that position. And so I think, you know, it's quite simple what's happened in England, which is that those people finally found us, and it took them 4 years, 5 years, but they got there in the end, and that partly is our fault that it took so long, because we weren't very good at saying it. We weren't, you know, I spent years saying to my Green friends, we believe we'd make most people's lives better. Why don't we ever tell them that? And I think finally we did, and that's what's changed. And one more thing, and then I'll shut up and let other people talk. But I think it's been really important in England, and really important to learn from, is that the party spent a lot of time ducking controversy and avoiding talking about things like immigration, where they thought that our policies aren't very popular. And I think that was a big mistake, because in politics you have two choices. Either you're controversial or you're ignored. And for a long time, we chose to be ignored. And one of the big changes with Natalie has been that she's been much, much more willing to pick some fights and to get in the middle of them. And, you know, and what happens is that, sure, on some of those things, there's only 20% of the country who agree with her. But those 20% are dying for someone to speak out. And if we got 20% of the vote in the next election, we would be delighted. So just being the voice for that 20% has brought us huge rewards. You know, and in England, that's immigration. I think, you know, I would guess that in Northern Ireland, it's different. You know, so things like, you know, hearing John talk about, you know, I will bring proposals on equal marriage back and back and back and back. You know, you don't need to have majority support for those things. So that can make a lot of strategic political sense. You know, likewise, you know, what we were hearing before about, you know, the right to choose. And, you know, I think Sinn Féin even changed their policy a bit on this is interesting, but they're becoming the party in Northern Ireland that stands up for that portion of the population who are frustrated that no one is able or willing to say these things, but that they feel dearly, I think is a hugely potentially powerful position for you. You'd know this better than I would, but I guess that's what I'd say. If there's a lesson to be learned from the Green Surge in England, it's that. It's, you know, get into that culture war, be controversial, get up, you know, and have that fight, because there's people out there who are dying for a party to represent them. On that, and on that, I'll shut up and thank you for having me.
can keep that one at that end. We've got one to keep as well. Yes, thanks very much, Alan. That's great. You talked about Scotland and the surge there, which was earlier at the Scottish referendum. So perhaps, Zara, you could talk a bit about the Scottish surge and what that meant.
Yeah, absolutely. Also delighted to be here. This is the first time I've ever been to Ireland, so it's great to be here, although I'll only be here for a day, unfortunately. But I am hoping the conference will show me a good Irish time and we'll have some pints after conference. I am Scottish after all, and that's why we make good friends. I joined the Greens in 2012, and my first party conference was similar to the size of this one, a wee bit bigger, but not too much bigger, in Glasgow in 2012. And it was at that party conference where a conference voted on a decision of where we were going to stand as a party in relation to the referendum question and how we would move forward with that campaign. And we decided, two-thirds of the party voted that we would support Scottish independence, and importantly at that conference we decided that we would have our own distinctive campaign outside of the generalised Yes campaign. And that campaign was Green Yes, and it gave us our own distinctive voice. And we got to put forward our own radical ideas within that. And I think that's really important, because that was key to our subsequent success, because we didn't get subsumed into a wider message. And we got to make sure that the ideas that we were putting forward were seen as distinctly green. And I think that was really key and really important to our success, actually, that came on the back of the referendum. So, importantly within that period, so this time last year, we had 1,200 members in Scottish Greens, and I checked in with our membership secretary this morning, and this morning our membership figures are sitting at 8,678. As Adam's already mentioned, most of those members did join on September the 19th, the day after the referendum. On the 17th of September, we had 1,720 members, and just a few days later, we had close to 8,000. So there was something, obviously, about that people wanted to stay connected, actually, to politics and to making change happen, because people got a real taste for democracy and got a real sense that there was, the people had power for the first time, and that we had the ability to change the system that we were in. And for the first time, many young people and women and other marginalised voices actually got a chance to express themselves in politics, and they connected with the Green message. We, for the first time, had a platform like no other, because obviously we were the Scottish National Party, which are our party in government, were pro-independence, as were we, so it gave us a huge platform, because they wanted us on every platform with them, because it actually gave their cause a wider mandate, and it gave it, it meant that it was connecting with more people, and it was seen as not just a political, a one-party issue, but actually it was broader. So we were invited onto TV debates and onto radio, and Patrick Harvey, which I'm sure he sends his apologies for today. He would have loved to be here with us. He's out campaigning for Ross Grier, who's one of our youngest candidates, and they're out campaigning today in Dumbarton. So, yeah, Patrick was on the TV a lot, and even I got on the TV as somebody that didn't, you know, I'm not elected and didn't really have much of a voice, but people wanted more green voices to make sure that there was different voices in the campaign getting heard. So that was really important. And it wasn't that we were actually saying anything different to what we'd been saying all along, but we had a platform to be heard for the first time. And we were able to speak on our own terms, rather than just being invited on when it's a convenient environmental issue, which we all know the frustration of as being shoehorned into environmental issues, because people only want to ask us questions about those issues. So then the public think that that's all we've got to talk about. But that's obviously not true. So for the first time, we were on TV and we were getting to talk about the kind of country we wanted to create, about a different economy, about more equality, about radical immigration policies. So we were getting to speak on all of these different things, and they really connected with people and put forward that vision. So I think all of those things were really key to our success. And when I've been speaking to members across the country who joined in the back of the referendum and asking them, you know, what is it? Why did you join us? And what made you sort of take that leap of faith? And we've got a lot of people who actually say that they realised that they've probably been green all along, but they just didn't know it. So lots of nods there, so people saying that that's something similar. So they say, actually, now that I got to hear that what green stood for during the referendum, and I realised that I've always been green, I just actually didn't really know it. That's a key thing. And also that people had taken the time to read the manifesto. So we have a lot of members who've actually taken the time to think about what they're connecting into. And I'm not saying that the SNP's membership aren't thinkers, but they definitely have joined up for different reasons. And I think that we've got a lot more people who actually want to take politics seriously and are joining on that kind of mandate. So that's been quite key and important for us. And I'm outgoing convener of Scottish Young Greens, and the party now has a third of our membership are under 30. So Young Greens went from having 200 members to now having over 2,000 members. At our AGM last year, we had about 9 of us sitting in a room, and at our AGM this year, we're hoping to have 100 Young Greens at our AGM. So that's been really significant and important for us, and something that's important because we're connecting with people who've never felt again that they've had voice in politics before, and people that have not been in part of a political party before, but have found a home in the Greens, and I think that's similar to what you're experiencing here as well. So that's a bit of the Scottish picture, and we've had other exciting things. So on the back of all of that, at our conference last year in October, John Finney, who's an independent MSP for Highlands and Islands, he handed over his membership form at our party conference and has just joined as a Green Party member. And we've had another independent MSP, John Wilson, who's an MSP for Central, has also just joined us. And they will both be fighting Holyrood elections next year on a green ticket. So we are starting to build momentum and movement where people actually are seeing that we're a credible force and they want to be part of us because they know that we've got stronger chances of electoral success. And it's very much people's perception of what it means to be green is changing in Scotland, and I think that that's giving us a lot of positive esteem to move forward with. Thank you.
Great. In the Republic of Ireland, of course, a bit further on than we are in terms of having experienced growth and experienced being, you know, an embedded, established party. So perhaps Roderick can talk to us a bit maybe about what happens after a third and what lessons we need to learn.
That's great. Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here today. And suppose I was elected as a councillor in May of last year. And you know, in Ireland, the day-to-day back and forth of politics, I know it can get pretty tedious. The minute sniping about little issues between the parties on the council. And then when I look at some of the issues you have to deal with up here, the kind of the brinkmanship on important bills that are all about benefiting the parties and not about benefiting people. And I look at the sectarianism you have to deal with, and even, you know, homophobia, you know, accepted as being a tolerable part of dialogue. You know, it makes me so proud to be here with the Greens today as a progressive, courageous voice for progressive policies, for progressive politics in Northern Ireland. I'm incredibly proud to be here. Republic at the moment. We had, like yourselves, we had local elections and European elections last May. We had good elections, but not great elections. We went from 2 council seats to 12 council seats, so a significant increase. There were another 4 seats where we were the last man or woman standing, sometimes maybe missing out by 20 or 30 votes, so we could have been significantly more if a few things had just rolled the other way slightly. We very narrowly missed out on a European seat and an MEP seat in Dublin. The party leader, Eamon Ryan, got a fantastic vote and was only 1,000 votes off out of 350,000 votes. He only missed out in the last seat by 1,000 votes, and that was the Fine Gael seat, the seat of the biggest party in the country. We could have knocked them out. So again, you know, it was close, but there's no point in I suppose, dwelling on it. You lost out, you have to move on. But that's, I suppose, that's the situation we're in at the moment. And why are we in that situation? Well, look, the obvious answer is coming out of government in 2011, a massively unpopular government that had to take massively unpopular decisions, and being part of that has damaged us. We heard about, I suppose, the anti-austerity agenda, an agenda that the vast majority of which we in the Green Party would agree with strongly. In Ireland, the anti-austerity agenda has really coalesced around two issues: opposition to any sort of taxation on private property, and opposition to any sort of payment for the overuse of water. Two issues that I don't feel have any real relevance to the social justice that I want to see in this country, and yet they have become the litmus test for what your opposition to, your position on the austerity issue is. So, whereas I suppose in England and Wales, here in Northern Ireland and Scotland, the anti-austerity agenda is much broader. In Ireland, it has really been narrowed to those particular areas, and I certainly don't feel that I can get in behind those particular issues. So that again has, I suppose, narrowed the scope for the Green Party in that wider political debate. That being said, though, since leaving government, but more importantly since the European and local elections last year, we haven't been, let's say, written off the field, and certainly the increased number of councillors has enabled us to have a much louder voice within the public debate. Our response to the issue to do with water charging was to call for our constitution to be amended to ensure that water as a public resource could never be privatised, a referendum to have a constitutional to amend our constitution. We had a coordinated effort between all our councillors to raise it within our local councils, and we had a very successful national petition. We gathered thousands of signatures handed in to the Taoiseach. He ignored us, but, you know, we have raised that issue on the national debate, and many of the other parties have adopted that same policy now as well. So I'd be hopeful in the next stall that we'll be able to see that policy develop further. Party leader Eamon Ryan has been able to use his expert profile to focus on the failure of the climate change bill that the current government is bringing in, a very, obviously, climate change bill, one would think good, but it's actually an incredibly weak bill that set out no target for reductions, and the mechanisms by which it will be enforced are not properly independent. And we've been able to use our enhanced media profile to focus on the failure there. More importantly, I think in the run-up to the general election next year, probably, let's say, in April of next year, we're going to use that campaign, because already in politics in Ireland we see that the auction politics that we saw in previous elections are coming back again. All the parties are talking about, we'll abolish this tax, we'll cut that tax. So even after such a sustained attack on public services, the idea of the tax cut being the central debate in the next general election campaign is taking off in Ireland. And we'll certainly look to make sure that the debate in our next general election isn't just about that. It's not just auction politics, but it's about investment in infrastructure and investment in our public services. We see that that has to be the central issue over the next 5 years in Ireland. Maybe just to say, as regards the surge, you know, the media in Ireland, they love talking about the opinion poll. They love the whole debate about the horse race. They would talk about that all day. They're not that interested in politics. You know, the every weekend is dominated by the opinion poll that's come out. I'm no doubt the same in England and Scotland. You know, what Lord Ashcroft's new poll has said would completely dominate all the media for that week. And I think that's damaging for all parties, because I think when the public see the debate being about that kind of insular issue, the horse race, they don't really care. They're not too interested in who's up a percent, who's down a percent, who's surging. They're interested in what are politicians going to do for me? How can their policies benefit me, benefit my life? So, and I think it's the points that was made by both the earlier speakers, it's great that we're in the news, and it's great that there is this talk about the green surge. But let's not, you know, let's not dwell on the surge. Let's dwell on, and let's use the opportunity, the fact that we're in front of cameras, that we have the opportunity to get articles and papers. Let's use that to have a laser-like focus on our policies, the policies that will actually benefit people, good for people and good for our planet. And let's spend the next time between whenever our next set of general elections are or regional assembly elections, let's use the benefit of the surge not to talk about ourselves, not to be seen to be insular like so many of the other political parties, but actually focus on the policies and demonstrate to people how by voting Green, by giving their Green candidate their number one vote, they'll be helping themselves in the long run. Thank you very much.
Thanks, that's great. One of the things you mentioned was very close elections, and our deputy leader, Claire Bailey, is an expert on that. We've also talked a bit about Young Greens and Claire's future constituency. South Belfast is, of course, the centre of the university area in the city. It's also the constituency in Northern Ireland that has the most Green Party members. I don't know whether there's a direct correlation there or not. But perhaps you could talk a bit, Claire, about why you think people are joining the Green Party in Belfast and what effect that's having on local politics.
Grand. Here, picking up on the green surge again, and I think, what is the green surge and why are people joining? It, rather than sitting looking at that, I say I am the green surge, and I have joined. I joined in 2011, so it's not a lifetime that I've been in battling it. I know that there are people in the room who've been doing the job an awful lot longer than I have. But for me, it comes down to a personal responsibility. I think there's only so long you can talk about wanting change before you have to stand up and start creating change. So that's when I got involved. Adam was saying as well that we're not a bit afraid of having the tricky conversations, standing up for issues that maybe other political parties would shy away from. And that's what I embrace about being free within a political party that allows that to happen. We have a set of founding principles, and so long as you are fitting within that, you know, get out there and get the message out there and don't be afraid. I'm not afraid. I think it's what politics is all about. Politics is about sharing ideas and creating change, and that's not what we see our politics doing most of the time. I think we're in a bit of a different environment in Northern Ireland where we are coming from conflict. We're moving out of conflict, apparently we're post-conflict, but the Green Party in Northern Ireland, for me, are the only party who exist not because of conflict, and that's really, really important. Every other political party that we see elected are elected because we come from conflict. Even Alliance, who say that they're a cross-community party, exists because of conflict. So their whole ethos, their whole discourse is centred around conflict, and what we do differently is have a different conversation, have different ideas, and have a different vision. We're also linked up. But we don't do it on our own because we are also linked to the Irish Greens, to the English Greens, the Welsh Greens, the Scottish Greens, the European Greens, the Australian Greens, the American Greens, I could go on and on. The global Greens are a movement, and we share ideas, and we share hopes, and we share aspirations. For the younger voters, or the younger population, they've grown up in Belfast in the absence of violence, so their world is not the same as my world. And therefore, I don't see why we should be putting our experience onto them. We should not be passing the legacy of the past as a torch to them to keep carrying for us. We should be creating something new and encouraging them to come forward and drive that forward. And that's what I really love about the Greens. I don't think we've had our surge yet. Can I be bold enough to say that? We've certainly had a surge, and it's been phenomenal. What I've seen happening, certainly with the Scottish referendum, is that there was something that captured the imagination of the population who got behind something new that came out in their politics, something new that represented them. What happened in England and Wales, again, being left out of the leadership debates, created a context, created something that brought forward a whole campaign that everybody got behind, and they had their surge. We've had a trickle-down effect with that, but I don't think that we've had our surge yet. So that's my, I'll throw that one out to you. Let's create the context for our surge, because it's right here and it's right now. Because what I get is that people are fed up with the established parties, because they're not talking anything differently. What they're actually doing is institutionalising an ethos of the past that does not fit our future, and we need to be ready to take that on board. We are anti-austerity, we are anti-neoliberal, broken system economics. We have something different to offer, and when we become confident in selling that and being picked up by the media and being able to be allowed to explore these ideas, will we see our surge? And I think that is right here and right now. Just during the lunch break there to a few members, and one in particular who's just not long joined up, and asking, why did you join? And I think it was a very simple response. He just said, he's coming off the fence. And our politics didn't suit an awful lot of people for an awful long time. I was one of those. But there comes a point when you can't come off the fence, and I think we are creating the conditions where people are going to engage politically, they're going to start sharing ideas, and when they realise that there is an alternative, we will get our surge. We're getting that taste of democracy, and we're seeing that it's not actually fitting who we are as a population, because what we're used to is a taste of theocracy, maybe. And a lot of our people as well, we see the development of our politicians becoming established, they become recognisable figures and faces, but I think that we're not in it for celebrity status, we're not in it for pensions, we're not in it to solidify ourselves as something powerful or somebody who holds power. We're in it for change, and we're in it for sustainable futures, and I think that will win out in the end.
Thank you very much, Claire. Thanks. That's great. One issue, of course, in my own county of Fermanagh, which has been absolutely central over the past 3.5 years, is the one of fracking, and the Green Party's firm stance and really hard work on fracking has really won us, great respect and affection, from the kind of frack-free community across Northern Ireland and beyond. But one interesting thing I noticed was that people didn't tend to join the Green Party at the beginning of that process. It's only really now, when we've shown that we can be trusted, that we're in it for the long haul, and that we're actually, on their side right through, that we're actually getting memberships through from people who are sort of central to that movement. I know that in England particularly, there are quite a few candidates in this election who've come through the sort of frack-free movement, people like Tina Rothery and Jess Mayo. So I'd be interested to hear the views of the other panels about those sorts of issues and how they affect us.
Yeah, sure. I think it's really interesting, because I think that there's, as well as being a shift from being seen as just a kind of environmental party to being people understanding that we have broader politics, that there's also been a change in the nature of environmental politics, which has been driven by people like the movement against fracking, which I think is absolutely crucial and really profound. And to explain this, I always think back to 2008-09. When the UK government ran what I think is the biggest public government awareness campaign in terms of funding in British history, which was called Act on CO2, where they put on adverts everywhere saying, change your light bulbs, cut your carbon footprint this way and that way and so on. And if you look at the figures, that didn't lead to any reduction at all in carbon emissions from Britain. But what it did lead to was a massive increase in climate scepticism. Because basically, if you say to someone that there's this massive global problem and it's all your fault, and it's because of the way that you failed to change your light bulb, and we're going to blame you for it, then surprise, surprise, they don't believe you and they don't like you very much. I think there was a long time when Greens were, not because of necessarily what we did, but were pushed into that box and weren't good enough at fighting back. And what fracking and other similar environmental issues does is it shifts that idea of where the blame lies to where it does lie. You know, the people responsible for climate change are not ordinary people who are trying to go about their lives in the system created for them. They're big global corporations, they're big companies, they're rich people who are trying to come in and exploit our environment and destroy our atmosphere and sell off our resources. And I think that in terms of green strategy, it's really, really important that we understand that, because the way that in the past the press and the mainstream parties tried to manage the threat from the Greens was to always say, basically, these guys are blaming you. They want you to change your lifestyle. They're preachy, they're annoying, and you should ignore them. And people often believe that. That was the most effective attack there's ever been on us. And I think we need to be really, really good at fighting against that attack. And I think fracking as an environmental issue is the best one we've had in a long time. And it's important to understand why, I think.
In Scotland, we have managed to push through a moratorium against fracking, thanks to the Greens. But we obviously have the Scottish Nationalist Party are very canny at playing a game of politics. So they are very good at taking issues and actually making it seem like they are the champion of that issue when we look behind it and we see that they're just playing a canny game of politics. So we have that situation going on in Scotland with fracking in particular, because the SNP obviously noticed that there was a general populace actually were strongly against it and have kind of changed their position in response of that, and obviously thanks to the Greens campaigning in that. But I think for me what's important about fracking and other issues that are coming forward as environmental issues is the narrative within that about actually it being about democracy as well, and the arguments about land rights and about who owns the energy and where the profits are going to go, and kind of bringing the arguments back to that. And for me, that's actually where people, ordinary people, outside of green campaigners and people that are already connected to environmental campaigns actually connect to issues like fracking. When you talk about it in a way that's connecting to what is important to people in terms of their fuel poverty, in terms of access to a different kind of energy source. And fracking has, you know, in Scotland now there's the exploration that's beginning to look at fracking underneath people's houses and beside communities. And I think that when these kinds of issues actually start to impact on people in a real way, that they can see how it will impact on their lives, that is when they begin to care. Not that they don't care before, but a lot of the time it's a luxury for people to care about political issues because they're too busy trying to do ordinary things like get their kids to school and, you know, actually try and get a decent wage so that they can afford to heat their homes and to eat. But when an issue becomes real to people, then obviously they're more likely to respond because they can see how it's going to impact on them. So for me, there's something about connecting the environmental issues like fracking and other ones that I think we've managed to do quite well in Scotland, where we're connecting the narrative to show people actually that it is an attack on their fundamental rights. And it's actually them that they own that land. And that if there's any jobs that will be coming from any industry, that will, you know, let's show us the proof. We want to see that this is jobs for people. And with fracking, none of those arguments are there because it doesn't bring jobs for communities, and it doesn't bring any resource back into communities, and it doesn't help people to pay their bills. So when you actually show that it's wider than just an attack on the environment, actually it's also an attack on communities, and it's again draining people of their resources to put money in somebody else's pocket. And then when we bring in these arguments and show that we're... And I think ownership is key to that. And obviously in Scotland, democracy is a huge buzzword, and we've got a real hunger for democracy now, and people want more of it. They don't just want more powers for Scotland, but they want more powers in every in every sphere. They want more powers in the workplace. They want more powers in their communities. They want more power and control over the resources that we have. So I think when we bring in these arguments and connect it in, then it's more powerful. So I'll maybe just offer that as a gift to you in your own campaigning when it comes to these things, is to try and join up the dots for people in a way that actually shows how these issues impact their lives and how we can make their lives better by campaigning on these things.
I think coming back to what Adrian was saying earlier on about maybe the idea that environmental degradation, climate change are people's fault. It's the people's fault. And, you know, I think certainly when I look to what the Green Party and the Republic used to say back maybe 10 years ago, there certainly was a slightly righteous, slightly scoldy element to some of the things that we used to say. And I think it's very important that we get rid of that, that we're not seen to lecture, but instead that we're seen to show people how we can make their lives easier, how we can help them, how we can make public transport cheaper so it is an option instead of taking the car, how we can actually improve, you know, the insulation of their houses to keep them warmer and to keep their bills down as well. I think that idea of showing positive steps that we can do is absolutely important in moving away from that scolding element. I suppose the issue of fracking has come up in Ireland to an extent, but probably a bigger issue that we've seen over the last 2 years is the issue of wind farms and a dramatic opposition to land-based wind farms from communities across the country. And obviously this again puts the Greens in a difficult position, because certainly we support wind farms onshore and offshore, but onshore as well, whereas particularly when you had very large multinationals coming in and buying up large tracts of land or the right to site wind farms on large tracts of land without any real element of public consultation. One of the issues Eamon's been working on over the last few years is, I suppose, a better consultative process to actually bring communities in to let them know this is what's happening, these are the potential downsides, but these are the upsides. Or perhaps most importantly, and it comes back to the ownership issue that you mentioned, community ownership of wind farms, because that's the model, particularly in Denmark, which is such a large reliance on wind farms now as a source of energy. Community ownership has to be important. So, and again, it's up to us as Greens and the wider environmental movement to demonstrate to people, but to actually bring in the policy platform to say we're going to move to a new model as regards the provision of community energy. So even though you mightn't always love the idea of a wind farm there, you're going to be getting some benefit to your community through whatever revenue is generated from it.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Alistair.
Down at what is an environmental issue. For me, social justice is environmental, and if we're not acting in the interest of social justice, we're not being environmental. We are anti-fracking, absolutely, and we will continue to be, but we're also pro-choice, pro-woman, pro-gay, pro-young, pro-old, pro-animals, pro the world, and I think shout that out, because that's pro-environment. Explain to people the process of exploitation that this faulty democratic system consolidates its power on, and how it sells its message and how it controls the information flow. When you allow people access to that they'll understand all these issues are environmental, and that's why the environment is not separate from anybody's individual living circumstances.
Thank you very much, thanks. We've got a little bit of time, just a few minutes really, for one or two questions from the audience. So there's a hand up there. Rory, can you...
Yeah, go on.
Just a couple of rows behind you.
Thank you very much. I feel the need to argue with Adam a bit. I'm sorry about that. I know that we share many beliefs, otherwise we wouldn't be sharing the room. But I would like to address the phrasing that you are suggesting that we should not be afraid of. That is, you mentioned that we shouldn't be afraid of using the words controversial and radical. I must say that I don't think these are the right words in this particular place. By the way, Slavoj Žižek, the contemporary writer and philosopher, says that it is not radical to expect and seek change. It is radical to think that everything can stay the same. We are not radical. We don't have paramilitaries behind us. We are not controversial. We are not pushing creationist views in the Alstom Museum's Fossils Gallery. We are down-to-earth, evidence-based, common-sense political party.
Does anybody disagree? Can't disagree with that. I suppose the truth is that we are in a position where common sense is itself seen as extreme.
John.
Thanks very much. The panel was very, very interesting talk there. My question is about the Green Surge. A lot of the talk is about opposition and the fact that we seem to be getting an awful lot of support and a lot of membership in because we are in opposition to sort of the current institutions and the current political frameworks. Do you think that it is simply an opposition movement, the Green Surge, and do you think that it's something that will last if that opposition goes away, or if we haven't moved with the government or to take up a position, will we vote for ourselves? Second, your thoughts on that.
Adam,
I talk about opposition. I think there's a really important element that it's not just side opposition. It's interesting that in England there were two or three potential other parties who might have become the one which kind of picked up that tidal wave. It could have been Left Unity. It could have been the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition. You know, there's a reason that it was the Greens. It's not just that we were around longest or we were first, which I think is that we did have specific ideas. You know, specific ideas to transform society. You know, what's popular in Scotland, and this is true in England too, it's not just that we're against austerity, it's also that we have an alternative economic programme, an alternative social programme. We're willing to discuss, and try not to use the word radical, common sense ideas, like a basic income, like democratic ownership in companies. You know, we're willing to talk about not just a sort of an opposition and not just a return to a kind of 1940s, 1950s imagined utopia, but that what we're trying to do is engage with the modern world and how to build a fairer society in the modern world, rather than and looking forwards, rather than either opposing or just looking backwards and harking back to a kind of fictitious previous era. I think, no, it's not just about opposition. It's really important to get people excited about new and try not to say radical, new and transformative ideas.
Thank you.